Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to the Two Norries podcast, ladies and gentlemen. We've part two here, and I'm joined here by my co-host James Leonard, as always.
Yeah.
So today we have Anna Courthold. Courthold.
Hannah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Hannah
Courthold. Hannah, we just had our husband on, just Niall Campbell. Mm-hmm. Great podcast as well.
Mm-hmm.
And Hannah, you work in clinical psychology.
Correct.
And you also work with psilocybin.
Not yet. So have had the training.
You've done some research in this area, and you're going to give us some background on it today, and some background around some of the stuff that's happening in Australia around MDMA as well.
Yeah.
So just to start off, do you want to give us a little bit of a background and who you are and where you came from?
Yeah, sure. So obviously not from around here. I grew up actually in Scotland, believe it or not, and moved to Australia when I was quite young.
Are your parents Scottish?
Mum is, dad's English. So so we immigrated out to Australia and moved straight to a country town, which was kind of odd to not go through a city. But it was great to kind of grow up in a small country town, you know, small school, didn't, you know, kind of feel too much pressure, I guess, growing up. And then moved up to Perth in my teens, like late teens, and have pretty much lived there ever since, but have done a lot of traveling and lived in a few different countries as well. So
how did you end up getting into clinical psychology?
Yeah, so it was a long journey. I didn't start out wanting to do psychology. I think it was something that came to me later on. Like I started out in fashion design, actually. So always was, you know, loved drawing, loved being creative as a kid. And that seemed like a natural progression to kind of go into the art world and study that. And just kind of, it was a passion.
Isn't it amazing how we start off one thing
and
we end up something completely different across the
totally
different kind of area completely. Yeah.
We're doing a fucking podcast. I'd never even heard of a podcast 5 years ago.
Neither did I.
Here we are.
This was something that was never kind of long-term planned. It's just something that just came out of thin air.
And
we went to it and it just changes your life. But that's what that indicates to me really is when stuff just comes like that with the flow, that means you're in an area that you're supposed to be in.
Yeah.
And you're doing something that, like,
and you're open to change as well.
I'd always had this sense that, you know, fashion wasn't really the right thing. Like, it was enjoyable, but I just felt like it didn't quite click. And I thought, maybe there's something wrong with me. Like, maybe I'm meant to feel more, you know, aligned with this. And but once I found psychology, like, started studying, didn't realize it was a 6-year degree until I got probably through my first few years. But then, just never looked back. Really felt like, and just continuously feeling like I need to learn more, and there's so much more of it to discover. And
do you know when you're studying clinical psychology, and you're looking at all these case studies and the research and stuff, you also at the same time learn so much about yourself and your own upbringing. Did that help you to become more in tuned into who you are as a person as well?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And I'd say, you know, I had done a lot of kind of soul searching, I guess, prior to starting. But then once I got into it, it really opened my eyes to certain parts of myself and certain ways of being. And, you know, you just, you learn about, you know, even just learning about all the disorders. You know, I was going around diagnosing everyone left, right, and center, yeah. But and myself. Yeah. But then I think you go through that stage of everyone's got everything, and then you kind of reel it back in, and it's like, okay. Mm. But yeah, it's definitely shaped me and helped me to deal.
Do you work one to one with people? No.
Sorry.
Do you work one to one with people?
Yes. Yeah.
So, like therapy.
Yeah, so I have two jobs. One is I have my own business doing autism ADHD assessment, and then my other job is working for an online psychedelic integration company called Enlightened Mental Health, and I also do a lot of like general therapy as well through that. So that's online therapy.
And the first thing you mentioned there, you know, if a child has autism, and I know autism is a spectrum, it's very wide, but just this specific one where they're nonverbal.
Yeah.
How do you do it? Have you ever had experience of trying to do an assessment? Or?
Yeah. So really you're looking at the behaviours and you're looking at the social interaction skills and things like that. So there doesn't actually need to be that verbalization. You know, you can still assess someone for autism without them really talking, and in fact that would be quite diagnostic, you know. Yeah. If someone is nonverbal,
I wonder, you know, like for you know, people that are nonverbal, mm-hmm. like that, you know, people that have autism, mm-hmm. and as they get older, you know, if they wanted to do some therapy, obviously the talking therapy is going to be out the window, but would something like what's the one we're EMDR. We don't have to kind of disclose the details of what happened. Would that be beneficial? Or would a kind of a psychedelic maybe be?
That's a really good question. Yeah. I mean,
you'd have to get somebody on this quite niche, no, I understand that, and put you on the spotlight, but just thinking out loud.
Yeah.
But so talk to me about psilocybin. Will you explain to us what psilocybin is, where does it come from, and how it interacts in the body?
Yeah. Well, it's the compound that's found in what we'd call magic mushrooms.
Plenty of many fields in Ireland at the moment.
Really?
There is.
Okay.
Yeah. That's why all the sheep are they can fly around the place at the moment.
But it's important for people to know as well, not all mushrooms are made equal, and some of them can be quite harmful. So you really have to know what you're doing.
Very much so. And I wouldn't recommend going out hunting if you don't know what you're doing.
So,
basically it has an effect on the serotonin system in the body. So it helps the serotonin to kind of stay in the brain, in a part of the brain for longer. So in the synapse, which you've probably heard of SSRIs.
Yeah, antidepressants.
Yeah, so those are antidepressant medications which are designed to help a person to essentially help them to absorb more of that. To keep that serotonin within the synapse, which helps people to feel, I guess, more positive. It helps people to feel less depressed, essentially. And that is naturally produced in our brains. And as Niall was saying before, you know, psychedelics wouldn't work if we didn't already have those receptor sites. It works on that system, and it's above my pay grade to kind of go beyond that explanation.
Yeah.
But
no, when I've taken magic mushrooms in the past, we won't go into the details. But you know, when you're in an experience like that, this how I was thinking. I was like, you know, the reality we're in now. We're sitting here in Cork City. It's an August after the evening, and we're doing a podcast, right? And this is the table is solid, the wall is solid. But maybe magic mushrooms gives you a glimpse into what the world is really like. And maybe this isn't the reality. Do you understand me? Mm-hmm. Like, I know, we know that, like, we live in a world made up of, like, if you zoomed into that in a high-powered microscope, you could see that it's not a solid object and that everything is moving.
Yeah.
And maybe a psychedelic gives us a glimpse into what the world is really like.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe this reality that we're living in now is our brains. We have solidifying everything to make it easier to understand and navigate on a daily basis.
Mm.
Very good point, yeah.
Yeah.
It makes sense to me as well, because anytime I've done any plant medicines, even if I was sitting down on a bench and looking at the floor, which is recently I've done San Pedro, I can't pronounce the real names. Wachuma. I was sitting down and everything was just moving. Everything was much, the clarity was there. I was getting massive amounts of information coming to me in relation to my life. And it was just saying, right, to me, this is where we have to go. This is going to happen. Mm. And 2 days later, one of the things that came up happened. Okay. Just happened. And it was like I was being set up for that. And what I didn't really understand the experience then. And then it wasn't making sense. But 2 days later, when one of the things that came up for me was after happening, I was like, whoa.
Mm.
Oh, that was powerful. But everything was so, so different. And what James said there makes so much sense, because when you look at how everything is in life, 99.99999% of everything it's energy.
Mm.
Matter is 0.00000.1%.
It's mind-blowing.
It's like, do you know, sometimes when I'm out in the open, James, and I just stand still and I just keep my vision looking at the one spot in the sky, I can see speckles of moving light, energy, just in the air, just here, and it's just bright, and it's just flashing back and forth, and it makes so much sense to everything. But because we're so materialistic and we believe in tangible objects as being everything, mm-hmm. we don't understand that everything is energy.
Yeah,
every single thing is energy, and I feel that energy within me when I'm meditating, when I'm processing stuff, when I allow stuff come up for me, and I do get a great understanding of it, you know. But with psychedelics, then, you know, if somebody hasn't maybe done some of the work already, Hannah, okay, and we all know what some of the work is, maybe a little bit of therapy, maybe a little bit going into their past, their own trauma, and maybe getting an understanding of it, and they're on inside in the lab, a research lab, and they're taking a microdose of psilocybin with some facilitators, doctors around them, and they go into a traumatic part of their past, what's a complete, they're blocked out of their memory, and it's come up from, you know, what is the best way to help somebody to get through
something
like that?
Okay, so yeah, when, you know, someone who doesn't necessarily have any experience of a psychedelic in their, they're going into this experience, maybe they have some expectation about, you know, I'm going to be healed, or it's going to be an amazing, wonderful experience. Sometimes it can be really hard, and we know that from all sorts of, you know, different, from research and from people who've been doing it for, you know, humanity has been doing it for thousands of years. So we have the accounts that it is when, you know, people use it in a spiritual way, and that's not always like a fun, la-di-da, you know, happy kind of experience. And there might be darkness that you might go into and experience parts of. So in the training for the psychedelic assisted psychotherapy, it's really important that we're all trained to help guide someone through a tricky experience like that. And so it's really about, well, you know, how can we help guide them through that? We're not going to, you know, stop everything and say, oh, no, too hard, don't let them go there, you know.
Yeah.
In fact, as you were saying before, you want to go into it. You want to go through it.
How do you, like, what does it look like, that therapy? Like, is somebody come into a room and sit down on we think of a Sigmund Freud couch, and they lay back, they take the dose, and they wait for the experience to happen to them? And how do you know the dosage? Is it like you give them a little bit and say, hold it on a half an hour and come back? How does it, what's the practicalities of actually?
Yeah, well, there are so many different things in motion out there, and when all different studies will do it different ways, but in general, and you've probably seen some of the documentaries, you know, about psychedelic assisted psychotherapy. So what it looks like, actually, first of all, you know, maybe the thing you don't see is the preparation work that goes on beforehand. So it's called psychedelic assisted psychotherapy because the psychedelic is taken within the context of therapy. So you will have had therapy sessions leading up to the experience, and then it's, you know, you have the dosing day, and that might look like, yes, you know, maybe you have like a nice comfortable bed or couch to sit or lie on. You might have like a blindfold, you might have music in earphones. There may be one or two therapists there with you. A lot of studies will do two therapists. We have not started the study that I'm a part of has not yet actually begun, so right. I can't say from personal experience, but if you do read the research and you watch those documentaries, you can get a good sense of the environment.
The one documentary that I watched, where there was maybe four or five different people going through the whole experience.
Mm-hmm.
So the way it worked was they brought them in maybe once or twice before the main session,
mm-hmm.
and they gave them a small microdose, and they sat with them and they watched what kind of tolerance they had.
Mm-hmm.
And after figuring out what the right dosage was, then they brought them in. They had a bed in a room. They had nice music and lighting around them.
Mm-hmm.
It was a comfortable room, nice space. Mm-hmm. And you had you had a psychiatrist, and you also had a psychotherapist, mm-hmm. sitting in the room, and they were comforting them while they were going through something of their past.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and they were, and but then afterwards, it was like, when they started doing the integration, which is the talking about their experience to maybe the psychiatrist or the psychotherapist,
mm-hmm.
they were explaining what was after happening for them.
Mm-hmm.
But the integration part of it is massively important. It's as important mm-hmm. as the actual psychedelic mm-hmm. in itself, because mm-hmm. some of the information that your brain might gather, right, it might change the actual wording or the understanding of it,
yeah.
where you might be told that something happened to you as a child, you were kind of maybe sexually abused or something was taken from you. But when you start talking about it to the psychiatrist, they'll explain how it works. The wording might be different. You know, so that's a massive part of it. But then you continue for four or five sessions after that talking about it,
mm.
and they're kind of consistently watching and see how you're getting on.
Mm.
You know, it seems to be massively influential.
What's the legality of it in Australia?
Yes, so as of the 1st of July in Australia this year, psychiatrists who are authorised prescribers can now prescribe MDMA for PTSD or psilocybin for treatment-resistant depression. That's not happening at the moment, because there's probably going to be some lag time in between now and getting this actually sorted out. How do we train everyone up to be able to support this? Because obviously there's a lot of hours that go into it. There are a lot of people on the team involved. Therapists and medical professionals and psychiatrists. And so all the logistics still need to be ironed
out. Is it an expensive treatment, do you think?
It will be. So that's another puzzle to be figured out. You know, how is it going to be subsidised, if at all? I don't think anyone wants it to be some sort of fringe treatment for the wealthy, you know. Yeah. Like,
because an all-five session with a clinical psychologist for 40 minutes
yeah.
be a price, a certain yeah. price, whatever.
Yeah.
But if you're sitting down and you're under the influence of psilocybin, that could go on for the day.
Yeah.
Half the day at least.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it might be two therapists. Like, you could see that would be very expensive.
Yeah.
And maybe quite elitist for people.
Yeah, estimates are around the $20,000 to $30,000 mark. Australian dollars so far.
The actual stimulant itself.
That's looking at what it might cost.
A small quantity.
Just to have that.
Sessions.
For that session. The whole process. Really?
Yeah.
And they are, like, it might start off at that price, like everything else. So anything new always has a massive label price in it.
Yeah.
But things like that. The benefits from something like that. We were speaking off camera earlier on when I would have used ecstasy as a young person, which is MDMA.
Mm-hmm.
Like the amount of love that I would have felt for myself and everybody around me whilst on that wasn't something that I felt on my daily routine of being just Timmy, the teenager who wasn't sure of even who he was.
Yeah.
And it helped me really to cope back then.
Mm.
And when we were speaking that it helps people with PTSD, it makes so much sense.
Mm.
You know, and it's so much better than going away and giving someone a prescription for a month there for maybe a depression.
Yeah.
You know, and all that's doing is blocking everything out.
Yeah.
So they can't feel anything.
Yeah.
You know.
But you know what you'd be thinking about as well? You know, people in homelessness that are chronic drug users.
Mm.
Maybe if we're looking at what's the difference between a millionaire spending 30 grand on this therapy and a homeless person using another psychoactive drug to help them deal with their traumas?
Yeah.
It's just like, are homeless people that use drugs, they're only using what's available to them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's available to them on the illicit market that they can get. They don't have access to psychotherapy, they don't have access to clinical psychology, but they do have access to drugs on the street.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this type of self-medication when you think about it.
So, yeah, I mean, that seems to be what we know about it. Addiction, isn't it? That it is a form of filling a hole that's there. But, you know, all substances are not created equal, are they? And some might be inherently harmful and others, you know, might have the capacity when used in a very conscious and careful way to help. And some people might find that spontaneously, like Timmy from your experiences on MDMA. You know what, I guess there's so much trepidation about, you know, what this is going to look like, because we don't want to drop the ball and all eyes are on Australia now and, you know, in this world, in the psychedelic space. So I guess everyone's goal is to really make sure that the standards are upheld, that people are being treated, you know, respectfully and carefully and, you know, different groups of people aren't being prioritized over the other, you know.
And another important factor as well is back in the 60s in the US when psilocybin was used for the first time and people were using trips and LSD and stuff, and there was so much, like, the Americans seeing the benefits of it initially when it was being treated in the right way to help people with...
There was a lot of research from back then, which just got buried.
But
then
it became this big thing where all the protests and stuff went...
And the anti-war left and all that.
Then it was just blocked. They were holding it.
It helped people open up people's consciousness and to think outside of the state and the government. And they didn't like that, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So what governments need to do and at the moment researchers need to do is look at ways that never happens again, because we lose the importance of these medicines to help people who are suffering with their mental health.
But you know, I'm curious to know about, do you know the MDMA, and I'm not sure if you have experience with that or know much about it, but like, do you know, for an MDMA assisted therapy, like, what kind of a dose are they getting? Are they getting a dose where, like it's obviously not like, here, take two of them, have a cup of tea and turn up the music, you know? It's obviously not that. Mm-hmm. But if it's not that, what is it? Like, are they buzzing, as we'd say in Ireland, he's twisted, he's buzzing out of his head.
Yeah.
Like, the feeling of euphoria, intense feeling of love and belonging, camaraderie and all that. Is it an intense session like that, or is it just a microdose just to help you tap into a part of?
Well, that's been the benefit of all this research through MAPS. You've probably heard of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelics. So they have done so much research with MDMA in particular, and they've kind of found a just right dose, which seems to get people to a state where they can process, they can go into really painful memories and they can kind of work on that, and they're still kind of with it, they're still able to converse back and forth, and
Hopeful, they are.
Yeah, yeah, but they're not kind of so so high.
Because when, what the keyword was there, they're still with it.
Mm.
They're still conscious.
Yeah.
Like when we were taking ecstasy back in the day, we were taking it to completely, like, nearly being in such a bad state that you're climbing the walls and you're getting the real benefit.
And you're drinking a lot of vodka down on top of it and stuff like that.
Do you know? Like,
not a great combination.
No.
The way you described it there, I can understand that because when I've used psychedelics in the past, ayahuasca and everything else, I was always with it.
Mm-hmm.
I was always conscious when the information was coming or when I was feeling something.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're feeling something and you're able to approach something in the right way with acceptance and love and everything else,
you're open to it.
It changes your life.
Everything
just changes, you know. I think it's absolutely amazing.
Well, it can do, and that's the excitement around this kind of new, well, it's not really new, but this format of treatment, because it seems to have that capacity when used in a really careful environment with obviously the safeguards in place, the therapy, the therapeutic kind of a good therapeutic relationship, that trust there, and also the preparation and then the integration as well.
Have you ever had any experiences yourself? Like, can you talk about that even if you did?
Yeah, I mean, I can talk about a legal experience that I've had in the Netherlands, and that was something which...
How was it?
So it's a truffle, a psilocybin truffle, I think. Yeah, so it's not an actual mushroom, and it still kind of releases the psilocybin within your system, but it's not, that's the loophole, I guess, figured out in the Netherlands. But
they're good at things like that.
Sorry?
They're good at loopholes in the Netherlands. Because the people think marijuana that is legal in the Netherlands is not. It's just tolerated.
Okay.
Yeah,
that was legal.
No, it's not. It's just tolerated. They're sensible. They're sensible society over there. Go on, Anya.
Yeah. One of the most profound experiences of my life. Yeah.
Can you describe it for people that have never tried?
How to find the words?
I know it's difficult, isn't it?
So I just remember kind of coming to and just, you know, coming out of it and just being this huge mixture of emotions about, like, why, how could this possibly be illegal? You know, it was one of the most beautiful kind of, I'm lost for words.
Weird experience.
It's weird.
It's not something we're used to.
Yeah.
Outside the box.
It's certainly a non-ordinary state of
consciousness. But you know, the thing I find with psilocybin and magic mushrooms or truffles, like when you come around, it's not like, let's say heroin, right, or cocaine, hard drugs.
Mm.
When you take that drug, when you come around, you want more of that straight away.
Yeah.
With mushrooms and psilocybin and stuff like that, when you come around, you're in no rush to go back into that.
No, it felt like I'd run a marathon.
Yeah.
And it was in equal measures beautiful and challenging and gentle, but then, you know, it sounds weird to say, but I felt like this sense that, you know, how can I deny that these plants have an intelligence, you know? Mm. And you hear a lot of people.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Say that, even though it sounds a bit, does sound a bit crazy to say, but the experience of it was for me personally, you know, that there was, they had an energy.
Is this the reason why you got into this field of psychology, or was that like part of the, like, how did you get into the psychedelic, like what drew you to this field? Or
it was the research.
Is it?
Yeah. So hearing about these breakthrough findings and obviously going through, you know, my studies and my experience and just seeing, okay, well, traditional therapy is amazing for some people and it gets some people a certain part of the way, but this just felt completely different, you know, in terms of what was coming out of it. And it's so different from a, you know, like a pharmacological, a typical pharmacological treatment, like an antidepressant, because you're not just giving someone a pill and just saying take this once a day and, you know, watch out for such and such symptoms. It is really the combination of that experience with the therapy that seems to have this this really promising effect, I guess.
Do you know all these plant medicines and everything else, people in the Amazons, they've been using these plant medicines forever, like, and they see the benefit of it. And I sat down with this lady recently and she told me this story. There was this lady and a child from, they were from a certain tribe in the jungle or whatever, and there had been a really bad storm, okay, on one of these nights. And she bumped into this lady and she was traveling from her village to one of the shaman, which was maybe 20, 30 kilometres away. And she met her on the road. And she's like, why are you going up to the shaman with the child? She said the child got so scared and she was full of fear from the storm the night before. She was bringing the child to the shaman to release the fear that was instilled in the child from the night before. Can you imagine what kind of fear is instilled inside kids today is that are growing up in traumatic environments, inside in homes where there's drug abuse, alcoholism abuse, violence, sexual abuse? Can you imagine what damage is caused to them kids? And when you look at the context of where we are here with this and how this lady here seeing the importance of bringing this child to a shaman to release the fear from the night before, do you see the gap of understanding of the two, the Western world?
You make a good point. Do you know, and we spoke about this with Blind Boy podcast. We were Blind Boy's guests, but it came up about something similar. But there's a French philosopher, Michel Foucault, and he wrote a few books, very good. He's very controversial now. He died of AIDS, and there's a lot of shady shit in his background and stuff like that. But he talks about, like, in Western culture, Western society, we kind of look back at our culture, we say 200-300 years ago, and we look at, like, we're progressing all the time away into a more humane and a more just society, and we look at these other cultures as, like, savages, backwards and stuff like that, and our culture is, like, the one we should aspire to. But if people in tribes, in Amazonian tribes or in Peruvian mountains, they don't have the comforts we have or the finances we have, but what they do have is an ancient technique to help heal this child from a fear so they can go on and move his life. And we look at that tribe and we say, God help us, look at them over there, they have nothing. And we're here with our, as I said earlier on, with your nice house, your nice car, and which your child is full of fear. You know what I mean? Like, who's actually the better society and which is the better culture? Do you understand?
Well, the thing is, you know, what we know about psychedelics scientifically is that it opens up the communication between different parts of our brain. And it seems that, like, that's the internal state. Like, we need to be doing that externally as well, you know. And I think it does help people to open up to connection to themselves, to nature, to the earth, to one another, to difference. And so when people start talking, you know, we learn stuff. Yeah. And so, you know, we have a lot to learn from those cultures.
Absolutely.
And they've learned from us, and you know, we can all learn from each other. So it's
there's a small bit of resentment as well. I was reading or looking at a documentary in Peru again, where those people that have used ayahuasca spiritually for centuries, looking at Westerners coming over now with the latest trend, and they kind of resent it. Where like it's sacred to them.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden you've all these white people coming over with their money, kind of overrunning it. But one of the things I want to ask you was, is there anybody that psilocybin-assisted therapy wouldn't be suitable for?
Yes, yeah. I mean, psychedelics are not for everyone. I don't think there's any therapy which is is good for everyone, right?
But if you went to a counsellor, and you spoke to them, it's not going to do any physical harm.
Yeah, that's true.
But it's a little bit different with this exogenous substance, like Niall spoke about.
Yeah. So, in general, in the research setting, people who are screened out tend to be people with a history of psychosis, if they have any family members or have a personal history of schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and even some personality disorders as well.
So. And you know, if somebody is going to take ayahuasca, if they're taking SSRIs, that's a big no-no. Is it the same with psilocybin?
That is something that, you know, the psychiatrist would obviously be in charge of, I suppose, in kind of guiding people through that.
But
I think in general, people tend to be, if they're going to be a part of a study, they shouldn't be on an SSRI.
You were saying earlier on that it's legal in Australia now, but it's only legal with the last 6 weeks or something.
Yeah.
So it's not up and running yet.
Yeah.
Is there any country in the world where this is a legal practice that is up and running?
Not that I know of. Even in the Netherlands, it's not legal to do psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy with psilocybin or with the truffles. There must be, but I'm not too sure personally.
I haven't really heard of any place that... I've seen documentaries based in the UK where they do the psilocybin stuff inside facilities like in hospitals. But the MDMA, which is something that really interests me because I never liked magic mushrooms, to be honest with you, because I had a few bad experiences.
I guess when they're testing out the dosage, you know, they give you a little bit, they belong to Timmy with 2 kilos of mushrooms. No effect on him.
I had a few kind of paranoid experiences, but I was off other drugs and I was taking magic mushrooms. And
your environment is crucial.
I was just like in a pub.
Then you're getting self-conscious. You need to be in a place where you're free, relaxed, you're not trying to hide what you're doing.
So you've heard of the set and setting, yes?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the set is your mindset at the time. Yeah. You know, you don't want to be going through something that's already pretty gnarly. You don't want to be going through something that's going to be, I guess, pulling you, making your experience a bit darker than it need be.
Like if you were going to do it with your partner,
and
then you can't really get into it because you're mindful of how she is.
Yeah.
Or is she
looking? Could be a part of it, yeah.
Yeah, like, whereas I think if you were on your own and you're there doing the session with a few strangers or on your own, then you can just completely relax and you don't have to worry about anybody or minding anybody. You can just really kind of surrender into it and get yourself in the right frame of mind for it.
Well, in my work at Enlightened, we do like harm reduction and the integration. So the harm reduction side is psychoeducation on set and setting. And it's kind of like, well, this person has come to us. We're going to provide a non-judgmental open space to talk about what that might look like for them, what are the risks involved, how that might, you know, what might come about, what, you know, potentially, you know, the types of things that can come up in those experiences. And then also to talk about, okay, the set and setting, make sure you feel safe and make sure that you're in a place, like a setting, where you feel comfortable. Maybe it's somewhere that has a lot of nature around. Maybe it's, you know, it's individual completely.
I'm not saying to mention, it's not MDMA that you buy off the streets that's mixed with all forms of different shit.
Yeah.
You know, it's made...
In the research, it's pure. Yeah.
It's pure, and there's nothing in it to hurt anybody in any way that shouldn't be in it. It's made properly with no bad stuff in it, and everybody's checked to see for the right dosage.
Oh, gosh,
and they have good people who are trained around this to watch them and to mind them and talk them through it when they need it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's very important to mention that as well.
There's a lot of people on to us now afterwards. Lads, where can I get some of that clean MDMA stuff from?
there are so many risks as well. So it's really important
to do the
research. And if you decide it's something you really want to do, then make sure that you are willing to take those risks. Yeah, it's obviously still illegal, so
You have to be good on yourself as well, and small, but you know, you have to understand where your shit is.
Yeah.
You have to know that your shit is here.
Yeah.
And like, if it comes up, that you'll be able to.
Yeah.
I always talk about, you know, this is not the be all and end all. There are so many other kind of practices that can help you get to similar states. Yeah. And I'm sure with you are fully aware of this with meditation, mindfulness practice, breath work, hypnosis, like Niall was talking about. There are a lot of different ways to do this.
Back to what you said about meditation and breath work, they're my long-term tools.
Yeah.
Like the MDMA and the other stuff will help you to get to a certain place,
whereas
the meditation will keep you in the good place and make it better. And better and better.
It's like what we spoke about with Niall earlier on. The psychedelic will give you a glimpse of what life could be like.
Mm-hmm.
And then the meditation and everything else helps you to walk towards that on a daily basis.
It's hard work.
It really is.
And it's not to be taken lightly, you know. So.
And just because it's not working today, tomorrow, in a month's time, or 4 months' time, don't give up.
Yeah.
Stick with it.
Yeah.
Because if you stop, you'll never know that you could have just hit around the corner and you could have felt something that will completely change your life.
Exactly.
Be consistent and integrate it into your life, like it's
waking
up in the morning and brushing your teeth.
Yeah.
Make it a part of your routine like that. And that was the game changer for me.
Mm-hmm.
When I wake up, no, it's not like, God, I have to go and meditate. It's like, right, I'm going to brush my teeth. What's the next step? But I meditate. Cold shower, brush my teeth, go downstairs, have a and I start meditating, and that's it.
And often the integration part is really just those simple daily practices, which, you know, if you just do it one day, it might not feel like much at all. But if you build it up day after day after day, you know, it can have such a powerful effect. And it's that kind of stuff that there are parts of us that really want to avoid, I think, because there's a bit of sabotage going on. Like, we know how good we could get if we just continued on with these practices. So to have that consistency, to have that, you know, regardless of how I feel, I'm just going to do this. I'm just going to keep at it and just have hope that even if I feel awful today, you know, I don't know what's around the corner, and I have faith that in these practices that this could get me to a better place.
Now, the other work that you do outside of psychedelics, do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, like as in the...
Working with artistic...
So that's really just it's an assessment kind of space. So I bring people in, you know, it's working with kids all the way up to adults, having a lot more adult clients these days.
Yeah, speaking today, the ADHD with adults.
Yeah.
In Ireland. A clinical psychologist can't prescribe meds to... They can't in Ireland.
No, they can't in Australia either. No, no.
Can't they?
No, no, no.
They can.
Really?
I think they can, because when I was talking to psychologists last time, I think in the UK some clinical psychologists get prescribed if they've done a certain course or whatever.
Oh, really?
Okay.
Okay.
But back here, it's psychiatrists are the only one.
Very much so in Australia then, as well. Yeah.
Follow on the GP, then go follow on that once the report is in. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I was just wondering whether it was the same in Australia. So obviously it is.
No, it's very much that the psychologist, you're definitely, your job is more of the psychology and the assessment process, and then the therapy side, and then the psychiatrist will do all of the medication side. And I think it's an unfortunate thing that rarely will they double up and do therapy as well. I think that would be a good thing to see more of.
What is it with autism, or is it just because we're more aware of it now? But I see a lot of autism. Like I work in youth and community work for Goodwill now.
Yeah.
And especially in the last role I was in, I see a lot of families presenting with children who are autistic. Like a load of them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what is it? Is it a Western condition now to have this autism in Asia and Africa and places like that too? Is it? Like, what's your opinion?
Well, as far as I'm aware, rates are pretty similar across different nations, across different countries. And I think we are possibly more aware now. So it seems like there are more diagnoses happening. And maybe it's because, like Noel was saying earlier, like there was a bit of an underdiagnosis period in that catching up a bit. But also, I mean, there are theories around, you know, what we're eating, what we're putting into our bodies, what we're putting into our systems in general, like toxins that go into our systems that may affect the developing fetus.
Yeah.
There are theories around...
Aspartame was one, wasn't it? It's a sweetener in diet quokes and stuff like that, linking it. And, but they're not proven either. You know, a lot of it can be scaremongering. There's no, like, definitive link between that and this, you know?
I think it will take more time and more research to really uncover
It's a tough question, isn't it, Hannah?
Yeah.
Like the reason that we're seeing so much. I think maybe one of the reasons is that we can actually diagnose somebody today, whereas back then when I was born, when I was growing up, if we had the same understanding of autism back then, the same numbers would be the same as what they are today. It's just back then we had no clue what we were looking at.
Yeah.
You know, and back then too, like kids, it was a different upbringing. Like, you know, kids today are wrapped in cotton wool. Back then you were thrown out the street and you were left there for the day. You know, and you when you were fed, if there was food inside in the house, you get it. If there wasn't, you didn't get it. But today it's like, it's just different. Kids are different today. Which is great.
Maybe back in the day when we were ignorant, a child presenting with so many issues, maybe they were bold, they were disruptive, they're just, whereas now we're more aware, say, no, there's actually nothing wrong with that child. They're not bold or disruptive. They have this condition.
Yeah.
And if we provide these supports, we can work through it, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas I'd say children in the 90s and nothing before, they were just written off and ended up in homes and facilities and places like that for the rest of their days, which maybe the children of today have way more opportunity for a better quality of life now than ending up in the facilities, you know.
Or they flew under the radar and, you know, just struggled, suffered for it and maybe thought, oh, this is just how everyone is. So I do hear a lot of that. You know, I just thought everyone had this experience of feeling like an alien or feeling completely
cut off. Must be very difficult for parents, you know, raising a child with autism, you know, especially if, you know, I remember Louis Theroux. Do you know Louis Theroux? Yeah. This English guy, does great documentaries. Yeah. He did a one, Tough Love.
Yeah.
It was in America and he followed a couple of families of children who had autism. Mm-hmm. But when I say children, these children were 15, 16 years of age. Some of them 15, 16 stone, big, brawny, they were very violent towards their parents, and it's just the unconditional love they had to persevere, but the toll it was taking on them and their relationship with their partner and the siblings in the house. You know, it's just like so hard for parents to manage that situation.
To build that attachment, you know, when you're not receiving the love and the, you're not receiving that reciprocity of the love that you're giving, it can be, you know, I hear from parents a lot. And you know, in fact, research shows that parents of autistic kids are among the most stressed out parent groups because of, you know, I guess the whole gamut of things they have to manage, you know, all the different therapy sessions But most of all, I think it is that attachment, you know, that sense of I'm putting all this love in, but I'm not feeling it coming back. And
so when you think about, right, a dog, and you think about a dog and why they have been so successful at integrating themselves into human life, a lot of it has got to do with eye contact and that reciprocity that you talk about. Mm-hmm. Like, we show that dog attention and, you know, that we'll get that back tenfold.
Yeah.
Lick at us, they'll stare us in the eye, they'll droop the eyes in a way where we feel sorry for them,
yeah,
and they come over and they show us unconditional positive regard we get from that dog. Mm. But it's, you have to be like that with children as well. And like, if we, children are hard work.
Yeah.
And if we put in the graft and we're out working, we're trying to get them, and then, you know, we make the best Christmas we can, yeah, and then you go down for the Christmas, the child warms the toys, and you're not getting nothing back.
Yeah.
Do you know, that's a very difficult place for a parent to hold.
But the thing that we now realise is that, you know, there is that love there. It's just not being shown in the ways we expect. So we have to teach parents how to interpret that love, and so we have to teach them how to understand the language of their kid, you know, yeah, that, you know, they may be doing little things for you here and there that are showing their love, but you're not interpreting that as love because it's not like the typical way you'd expect to receive it.
Mm-hmm.
So once I think parents understand that, they can feel a little bit more uplifted and feel like, okay, this is worth it, and you see parents kind of coming out the other side a bit and feeling, yeah, more. It kind of lifts their spirits and helps them to get through, yeah, the stress that is involved.
No, children that have autism then, or people that have autism and they're in that space, like, are they aware that they're not given the eye contact, or they're not given the verbal acknowledgement, they're not reciprocating the love, attention and affection that's being given to them? Are they aware of it, and do they feel guilt and shame about it? It's just something that they can't help, or they're just completely not aware of it and they're just getting on with their day?
It really depends, because I think IQ plays into it as well. So, you know, once you're made aware of something, then you might start to pick up on it, right?
Yeah.
And so if you have autism and you're quite intelligent, you might start to go, oh, someone gave me that feedback that I don't give good eye contact, and then you might notice that, and then you might develop more social anxiety about that.
Mm-hmm.
And it might, just because it doesn't come naturally to you, you might then either try and start to force it or just maybe completely avoid it altogether because it's too anxiety provoking. So it can kind of depend on the person. Yeah. Whereas some kids I just see, they actually seem quite oblivious and, yeah, you know, yeah, like in a lovely way, they just kind of go about their stuff and they don't really seem to notice how their behaviours are different from others. But, you know, then again, that's me just observing. How do I know their internal experience?
Yeah.
In your eyes, what should we be doing more as societies, you know, in to be able to help everybody across the board, right? But just let's say we're focusing so much of our attention and our funding in prisons and in the youths and teenagers. It's my belief in this area is that we should start focusing a little bit more and putting more money into our early childhood, our early days stuff, right, where we should be putting the right people into childhood settings, you know, early education, schools, more counsellors, instead of having all these difficult subjects like for kids in relation to religion and other stuff that's irrelevant to their well-being.
Mm.
We should be implementing subjects like maybe mindfulness for kids, you know, maybe ways of talking about emotions and stuff, how kids can deal. And I believe if we started doing that, we'd have less in prisons in 20 years, less inside in treatment centres, less people inside in psychiatric wards, you know, less people on the streets.
Yeah.
You know, how come the people that are responsible with the power in all our different governments cannot see the importance of doing the work right now when they're 0 to 6 to 7 to 8 and helping them to process, so when they do come across difficulties in their lives down the line that they can't manage or sit still with, and they have to go in and find a substance or alcohol or gambling or whatever else to be able to cope, how come they just can't see that and understand that if we do the work here now, down the line, 20 years' time, we're going to see a massive difference in our societies, in prisons, you know, in our treatment centres, in our hospitals that are overloaded, you know, on our streets where you have tents everywhere, people that are struggling, you know, to find somewhere to live.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a hugely complex issue and probably outside the scope of my knowledge, but I think it's, if you think about the system that we're set up in, you know, just even thinking about the term of a prime minister or a president, you know, that's pretty short term. And if the aim of your game is to get enough votes to get you in again or to get your popularity, like, maybe you're not thinking that long term. And that's, it's not that that person doesn't want to be, I'm sure. But I would say that that stuff is happening. I think we are on the right track. But to bring it back even down way, way back, just to the attachment, to really be focusing in on, even when a mum is pregnant, you know, identifying risk factors, like identifying, okay, well, what has she been through in her lifetime? You know, what, how is she going to bond? Like, what is her current setup, her social setup? How, you know, how is she going to develop a really stable and loving relationship with a newborn? And how is, like, the system around her going to support that? So there are so many things, and I think we are waking up a bit to that, you know, bringing it right back to that, those really early years, because, yeah, I mean, it does seem to be where a lot of...
Yeah,
and I suppose the more we speak about it, the more ears that will listen, and it's about talking about it and just letting people know that we're here.
Mm. Yeah. If people want to say hi, Hannah, and connect with you, how can they do that?
Sure, so... if they're interested in the kind of integration work, that would be enlighten.com. It's enlightenmh.com. That's the company I work for. And if they want to just reach out and chat to me personally, that would be via my website. There's a contact form. It's hannahcourtauld.com.
Thanks a million. Been a lovely guest. Pleasure speaking with you.
Do you know, myself and James, we get so much from listening to people like yourself and your husband, and... it just informs us a little bit more, because you've the research done and you understand this a little bit more than us.
Sure.
But we've the experiences of our own kind of stuff. And when we're back and forth, you know, it's a great conversation.
Yeah.
So thank you so much.
I'm blown away by your knowledge as well. You're both so knowledgeable.
We've a lot of knowledge with psychedelics.
Well, I learned.
Elicit.
I've learned a lot from this conversation.
It was great. It's great. Thanks. Listen, thanks for your time, and safe journey home to Port.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
See you later.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.